Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Philip Beverly, Stephanie Hitt, and Mike Miller. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in downtown Chicago. Back home in Chicago after a couple of weeks in California. Phone lines open, 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it is beyondthebeltway.com. And if you'd like to tweet us a comment, it's at btbdumont, at btbdumont. Well, once again, on this Mother's Day 2014, we find ourselves, as we have for many, many months on this program, we find world situations that are really affecting people, millions of people around the world. And we get, as the greatest and most powerful nation on earth, we seem somewhat powerless to do much about it. We're going to be talking about that this evening. But the broader question I would like to ask each and every one of you listening to the broadcast this evening: at what point should the might and power and influence of the United States be exercised to right wrongs? It seems to me for the last four presidential cycles, there's a question about whether or not the United States should be the policeman of the world. Well, we have a situation now in Nigeria where close to 300 students, young girls, were kidnapped. I guess the number is actually 276, were kidnapped by Islamic terrorists. And we're going to talk about that this evening, but we seem somewhat powerless. We want to do something about it. We are outraged, as the world is outraged, and there's also a growing movement on the Internet to raise visibility. And now whether that visibility will in any way affect those that did this dastardly act, I highly doubt it. But again, more and more people seem to be engaged in what is happening around the world, abuses that are happening around the world. And yet, what can we as the greatest nation on earth do to protect ourselves and really to define a role for the United States when these circumstances arise? That's basically the discussion this evening. Yesterday, First Lady Michelle Obama gave the address, the official presidential address. She delivered it herself, and she talked about the Nigerian situation. And she said, quote, "Like millions of people across the globe, my husband and I are outraged and heartbroken over the kidnapping of more than 200 Nigerian girls from their school dormitory in the middle of the night. This unconscionable act was committed by a terrorist group determined to keep these girls from getting an education. Grown men attempting to snuff out the aspiration of young girls." End of quote. Stephanie Hitt, you're one of our Republicans this evening. You're also a mother, and you also get outraged at sometimes when the United States gets trapped into circumstances and seems somewhat powerless. What can we do now in this situation, in your view?
Well, in the immediate sense, what we can do is we can send intelligence support. We can send logistical support. We can provide mapping kind of functions and things like that. We can give those kind of resources. Unfortunately, our hands are tied because until a state requests our physical military presence, there's not a lot we can do militarily. However, there is a tremendous amount of things we can do in terms of providing tools and technology to help track a lot of these girls where they are supposedly taken up along the borders. It's not necessarily the deepest of jungle. There are ways in which we can track these things technologically.
And some of that support has already been provided to Nigeria. But let me ask you the question, Philip Beverly. Talk to us about the politics of the Nigerian leadership. How much can they be seen as publicly reaching out to the United States and asking for help without somewhat admitting their own potential complicity in this act?
Well, beyond their complicity, they have sort of the now surpassing South Africa, the largest economy on the continent. And so that brings a bit of perceived power. And now they're going to be perceived as being impotent, having to go to the United States to get the kind of help that they need. They can't manage the situation themselves, either with international partners or even domestically, because of the the conflict, ongoing conflict with Islamists in the north and Christian and animist populations elsewhere in the country. It's a really difficult situation for them. I would the thing I would add to Stephanie's perspective is maybe we shouldn't necessarily see this in military terms exclusively with U.S. military. Maybe it's more suited for a PMC.
Mike Miller joins us from DePaul University.
I think I've been drifting along with the American people becoming a little bit tired, I guess, is the only word I can think of in terms of going overseas and trying to be the world's policeman. And I think what is happening over there is terrible. But notice in the statement from the First Lady, they didn't say Islamist terrorist. They said terrorist. I think it's clear. The problem is this is not our battle. The people who could fight it, in my mind, are the moderate Muslims and Arabs and all that part of the world who can come down and do many of the same things. They're closer than we are. They could show that we're going to stop this kind of terrorism. We don't in any way endorse this kind of nonsense. But we're not hearing that at all. Why do we have to be the ones that are doing this? I'm not sure. Stephanie, you mentioned there's not much we can do. You know, banging your head against the wall just to show that I care. I mean, we got to be adults about this. If you can't do anything, don't try to pretend.
Nigeria has not officially asked for our help, so we cannot actually go in there and bring support and forces and troops in there. And, you know, it's a very, very, you know, African politics is very crazy. You know, it's kind of crazy over there. And we're talking about here's a president who is hanging on to his power by the skin of his teeth. It is he is facing a lot of pressure. Nigeria is a very disjointed state. And so there's not a lot that he cannot look weak in the eyes of a political electorate there. So he's battling those fronts. So he can't call on us.
What about to Mike's point about when, you know, when you have these efforts about, you know, the hashtag diplomacy?
Oh, boy,
and you've got Michelle Obama and you've got all these celebrities coming up. They want, I understand what they want to do. They want to use the new media, the new social media, to raise visibility of an issue. But I asked in my opening comments, do the people on the other side, do they care about hashtag diplomacy?
No.
They don't have.
These are terrorists.
They do not have the technology.
So is it a false sense of feeling good?
Of course.
Very much so.
About ourselves.
Western sensibilities in a non-Western environment.
Well, and that's the thing is you're assuming that they have radios and communications and computers and satellites and things like that. Those things don't exist. They're very rare.
What would you say to those? And, Mike, I'll let you come back to it because it's your point. What would you say to those? Not just women, but people all over the world. I think there's over 2 million people that have sent something already. What would you say to those people that, you know, are holding up that sign that says hashtag, you know, save the girls? What would you say to them?
Well,
I want to get Mike's response.
I hope you feel good now. You didn't do anything, but I guess you feel good.
Well, here's
I want to get your reaction. We do have to pause. 1-800-723-8229. Where do you come down on what role the United States can play, not only in this current situation in Nigeria, but when these circumstances arise again? And they will arise again. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Stephanie Hitt, you wanted to make a point about what message you would send to those people around the world that are holding up their hashtag sign saying save the girls.
I know Mike is very concerned about the United States being the world policeman, but nonetheless, we are given that role because we are, you know, so powerful. We are free. We're incredibly influential around the world, and it's a responsibility that we need to take. When I lived in West Africa in the mid-80s when Ronald Reagan was president, and I will tell you, there was a very strong international presence under Reagan, very opposite of what we're experiencing today under this administration, where we're pulling out of places and we're receding and coming back into ourselves. There was a feeling, and it was very clear, of the U.S. was very powerful, and just the sense of that power and the fact that the U.S. was omnipresent, although not interfering, but there was enough to keep a lot of these regions very stable. And I think that it's a long-term thing. It worked in the 80s incredibly well and in the early 90s and through the 90s.
But Nigeria in the 80s was a military dictatorship, and dictatorships by their nature are going to be stable. So I don't look at stability as being necessarily the goal. I think we should have some other factors included, maybe human rights and free press and judiciary, and not just look at stability. Iran was very stable under the Shah. And look what happens.
Folks, we're going to go to calls. We're going to go to Jim in South Elgin. He has a specific response to my opening question as to whether or not we should be the world's policeman, and if so, how do we pull it off? Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I think it's a shame because Obama is decreasing the military's effectiveness, and this is part of the problem. I also think we should go into some special ops people, rescue those girls, and kill the guys that did this.
All right, now, but let's backtrack. So what you're suggesting, which everyone is cautioned against, is you believe we have to be invited into a country when it becomes apparent that that country, for whatever reason, can't deal with its crisis.
I think for this specific instance, I don't think they would turn away our help. And I think if we went in and rescued those girls, I think that would send a loud signal not do it again, and would show our side to be the good side.
I can just hear the op-eds. I'm just waiting for this over the next week or two. Two things I'm going to see in the op-eds. One is that the white man has to come in and save the black country. It's going to happen. I hear it at universities all the time. The second thing is, I use the word Islamist, and I don't know why the First Lady didn't say Islamist terrorist. That kind of talk, because it's Boko Haram, we're going to be branded it. We're branding the entire
Crusaders.
Religion because we're looking at this one group of fools. And I am not branding the entire religion. I've been
again,
in the Middle East a lot, going to lose.
In this particular case of the Boko Haram, I mean, clearly they are killing moderate Islamists.
Oh, yes,
absolutely.
Not just Christians.
But your point at the beginning of the broadcast is, where are the other moderate Islamists? Do they have the power and influence and the gonads, frankly, to stand up and fight it?
Yes.
Or are they too feared for their own life?
Just think of all
the... That's it. They're afraid.
And they got lots of money up in Qatar and Saudi and so forth. Where are they? Why aren't they saying, let's send money, let's send help and whatever, some people? You know, Jim in South Elgin, I guess I don't want one of our soldiers being shot while trying to save these girls. Let them save these girls.
Or it's let them hire someone to save these girls.
Just like the Saudis did with us during the first Iraq war, kind of hired us to fight the war.
Let's not hire any U.S. military.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
All of this presupposes we cannot go in there. We have to make that very clear. We cannot go in there unless we are asked.
Yeah, well, I don't...
And so,
go ahead, Jim, respond to that.
There's no national interest.
You're not getting any help, any support for your idea.
I think if we were to make a phone call to the people in where it happened, if they were going to come in and help you, I don't think they'd say no.
But keep in mind that almost daily, I was watching it a couple months ago. I was purposely watched the newspaper. Almost every single day, there's a bombing at some mosque or at some religious event where 25 people are killed, 50 people are killed, and so forth. A couple of months ago, a whole bunch of boys, I believe they were all Christians, which means they were apostates, they were burned to death. They folded up the doors, they blocked the doors, they set it on fire. I guess there was no hashtag. I'm certainly not going to get this into boys versus girls. But it's interesting that we're all of a sudden picking this case. Now, of course, the girls are alive. We all hope that that's the case. And we really wish that there'd be some way to stop this nonsense. But this isn't our battle. And there's so little we can do. We're going to fail. And if we fail, we're going to be all these things I've been talking about. And if we win, we're going to be, you know, oh, it's the multi, you know, you're coming in here and coming into our lands and trying to show us how to do things. And we can't win. We can't win in this.
The cost of winning is very pyrrhic here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in this particular case, Boko Haram, one of the things that they are doing is their massive recruitment. They have been responsible for many of the prison breaks throughout the region. So someone is released from prison or escapes from prison. So they may want to be appreciative of those that help them escape. They're looking for young men between the ages of 17 and 30. And they're being they are the most restrictive of all, the most vehement, you know, believers in Sharia law. And they will not stand for moderates.
No, but
and by the way,
no.
I'm going to say something, and I hope everyone understands that I'm not trying to draw a specific comparison. I want to say that because I want to say what I'm about to say very carefully. There are those in the Republican Party in the United States who will view anyone that is moderate as worse than a liberal Democrat. They hate the rhinos. They hate anyone who isn't pure. And I'm saying that there is, in this case, within the Islamic world, there are a lot of people who are very, very extreme, and they will take no one who is moderate, who speaks in any moderate way. They would rather have them dead.
Right.
And there, I think there's a similarity there. I mean, it's the issue of extremism versus moderation, and that's what we have here. And I think we see that in so many places around the world.
Well, and it's not just that. What is drawing a lot of these young men to this is the fact that this is happening around the world in countries where there is no economic opportunity. There is no hope. There is no place for young men to build lives in these societies.
We could say the same thing about Inglewood in the city of Chicago.
I was going to say, and we can look at that, is they're drawn into these gangs where there is a power structure, there is a family provided, there is a purpose provided.
There's a
purpose, if you're just serving with your life for some reason.
I think one of the questions that we are dealing with here tonight can be the forerunner of a very serious conversation that will take place to some extent within the Democratic Party, but much more within the Republican Party, especially the, you know, you can call them the isolationist wing, but the Rand Paul folks and others in the party who feel, as Mike Miller feels, that we can't be everywhere. And so I think deciding and discussing and debating where the country goes, I mean, this is not a discussion that's going to go away because it bitterly divides a lot of people. And we are seduced and we are swayed by the emotions of each individual incident. Anyone that is a father or a mother or anyone that is breathing should know that when you kidnap, you know, close to 300 girls at gunpoint and you whisk them away and their lives are being threatened and endangered, that's nothing good about that. But on the other hand, you know, in the movies, somebody stands up and is strong and they
there's
say,
a helicopter in the middle of the night.
Mike and I may disagree, and that is, you know, I believe in an America that provides is an example of hope around the world. And one of the things I saw when I was in Africa with the strength of America is that people looked at America as an example of where there is hope and opportunity. And I know it may sound a little corny, but people really believed in that. And they saw that.
The first lady holding up a sign, the first lady holding up a sign to save the girls with her hashtag, then you think there's a positive aspect of it. Because if that picture is seen by women in that part of the world, they know there is some solidarity. So that act maybe shouldn't be...
It may be helpful. However,
it's symbolic.
The most important thing is seeing an America that is strong, that stands behind its principles, and is open to sharing its optimism and its values with the rest of the world. That is key.
But, you know, it seems in this instance, not the best thing, but a thing that we could do is really walk our talk. If we have the same problems that developing countries are experiencing in pockets around our own country, a commitment to addressing that would be standing behind those principles. And we haven't done that. We've talked about it, but we haven't done that.
We did it with AIDS in Africa. We did it with AIDS in Africa. It started with one administration, and it grew tremendously during the Bush administration. AIDS is one of those issues that it was bipartisan, and the United States did something. And thanks to the presidents of the United States, millions of people are still alive.
Yeah,
don't you give me credit for that?
Of course, we should. We should, and what we did was fine. But I also know that some of these countries, their leaders say that AIDS is not caused by the virus,
right.
And they try to pass out the condoms, and, oh, you can't use them. This is the West.
To a very uneducated.
I wanted it to work.
We've got to pause.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we'll take more calls. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. Let us introduce our guests, or let them introduce themselves. Philip Beverly, we'll start with you.
Oh, Philip Beverly. I'm a professor of political science, associate professor of political science at Chicago State. Have been there for, it'll be 23 years in August. Glad to be on the show. Want to wish my mom, Arta Beverly, a happy Mother's Day. Thanks, Mom.
Stephanie Hitt.
I'm Stephanie Hitt. I'm a political activist from Evanston, a mother of four, so I'm taking the day off from being their mom today. And I want to wish my mother, Carol, a wonderful Mother's Day, and my mother-in-law, Patty. And I want to cheer, and I spent my day cheering on volleyball players.
So you're losing your voice. I'm losing my voice because I've got post-nasal drip.
Yes. Oh, lucky you.
Mike Miller.
Mike Miller. I'm an associate professor of economics at DePaul. I've been there 34 years. And my wife, the mother of my two boys, she's in Pennsylvania taking care of her parents. They just had some major surgery issues, and she's doing what daughters do, and very strong and taking care of things.
And many people that are listening and watching the broadcast this evening, they have lost their mothers. You have lost your mother.
In the 1990s.
When you think of her, what is the trait or what is the thing that is most lasting?
Well, you'd have to know my father, who drank too much, smoked too much, and she was a saint. She kept the family together, and all five of us, the five children, turned out really well, as far as I'm concerned. Not one of us mucked up, and it was because of her.
Yeah,
well, she's a good woman.
I would say the same thing. There was not a drinking problem in my family, but again, my mother held three children together in very difficult times. So that's the memory I have of all the, when I hear people struggling and complaining about what their lives are, raising three children in basically a two-room apartment on the north side of Chicago in the 1950s was not an easy task.
It's
She survived, fortunately died many, many years ago. I want to mention one other thing that's coming up, and then we're going to get back to our discussion, take some calls. Next, there's a group that's in the Chicagoland area. It's called Thousand Waves. They're basically a martial arts and self-defense center for women. But they have a program that they make themselves, make people available to work with those who are disabled. And it's really a program to deal with those that are disabled. And next week, they're having probably one of the most articulate and one of the most well-known blind people in the United States, Tom Sullivan. You may know that name. Next Sunday afternoon, there's going to be a lecture. It's called Adventure in Darkness. It's next Sunday, May 18th, from 3 to 4:30 in the afternoon on West Belmont Avenue. It's called Thousand Waves. You can give them a call if you'd like. It's free, by the way. There's no charge here. But again, if you'd like to know more about this program, to work with those who are disadvantaged, in a physical way, physical disadvantages, it's a program for them run by Thousand Waves. You can either give them a call at 773-472-7663, or you can go to the website www.thousandwaves.org. Good work. And again, Tom Sullivan, who's a remarkable person who has an incredibly inspiring story, will inspire anyone that's there. So if you're listening to the program and you have some disability of some sort, it is a program that you may want to know about. Let's go back to calls. Let's go to Rich listening to us in Evanston on WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air. Rich, are you there? Well, I guess Rich is not there. So let us go back to the discussion and the debate that I was asking about, is whether or not you think this will be part of a 2016 presidential race, or is you have the isolationists versus the interventionists. What should we do?
I don't know that this will be part of it. I think if anything, it might be an example of a broader discussion of whether or not we're going to increase the U.S. presence around the world. And part of that would be in contrast with what's going on with the current administration. I mean, we've just drawn down troops in Afghanistan. We see what's going on. We've withdrawn some support and presence in Eastern Europe. And now look what's happening with Putin encroaching back. So it's also, if we look to the Pacific and we see what's going on with both China and Russia filling in the gaps that we're leaving, that it's going to be part of that bigger discussion of where's the U.S. presence.
Can you have that conversation? If Stephanie went out and tried to make that conversation, that point, on the south and west sides of Chicago, she'd have a hard time getting through.
That isn't going to, as Ann Richards said some years ago, that dog won't hunt until we have a fuller discussion of how are you going to pay for this. The military isn't being drawn down because a president has decided, oh, I think I want to weaken the country. The military is being drawn down because it's extremely expensive, and we've got a sort of tax system and economic condition that's a little bit out of whack for us to be as prominent as maybe I would even like us to be. The economic reality is we can't afford to do it. If somebody else wants to foot the bill, I think any administration would say, yeah, we should be in places that you mentioned.
Well, and I think that opens up, you know, when we're talking about 2016, to a broader thing, and that is, you know, restoring America's presence and restoring America's economic strength. We can table this discussion for later, but there is clear that, you know, a lot of this administration, a lot of what the Senate is either trying to do or stopping Congress from doing is holding our economy back. And we could be a stronger economy. I mean, I think we had less than one-tenth of 1% growth over the last year.
But from a practical standpoint, going back to what the world is focusing on right now, mm-hmm. you've got a situation where 276 or, you know, a large number of Nigerian young women have been kidnapped by a terrorist organization, an Islamic terrorist organization, a very extreme Islamic terrorist organization, that doesn't think women should be educated, that is so anti-Western, they want to keep women stupid. That's what their goal is.
Right.
And very similar to what happened in Pakistan, a 14-year-old girl who goes to school gets shot in
the
head.
Yeah.
And there's outrage, and yet there's really no change. I mean, to me, the underlying thing is violence against women, whether in an international or domestic sort of context. And if we can address it domestically, then maybe we'll be better at addressing it.
And by the way, Michelle Obama referenced the Pakistani girl that you just referenced and said that the courage of that young child, in addition to what's going on in Nigeria today, or who knows where those children are at the moment. They may not even be in Nigeria. But she said it should serve as a call to action for Americans to value a quality education in the United States. Now, this is where there may be a connection to what's happening on the south and west side of Chicago. This may be a message that they can relate to. And
this,
I mean those
this is the so- this is the walking the talk.
But this is not part of the war on girls or women. I mean, when you look at the performance of girls overall in education compared to boys, the boys are the ones in trouble, not the girls.
No, but her point, just to finish her point, she said to value the quality of education in the United States and to make sure that their children do not slack off or drop out. She said she hoped the captured Nigerian school children would inspire Americans to stand up for girls, not just in times of tragedy or crisis, but for the long haul. And I think she also to extend it, I mean, it's anyone who can use this as a learning experience, which may explain, I mean, if I'm living on the south or west side or in any impoverished area of the United States, and I'm saying, why are these people talking about sending, not troops, but they want to send all this money, and these, you know, it's horrible that 276 Nigerian children have been kidnapped, but what about the people on the west side who can't walk out because the kids are going to get shot?
But think of, I guess, you know, the word would be irony. We're leaving Afghanistan. The group that we fear may take over once we're gone is the Taliban, and we all know what the Taliban stood for before this all began.
Same thing these people.
Exactly the same thing.
Exactly.
That girls could not be educated at all, that the girls could not leave the house without a male, that a female could not be seen by a male doctor, so women would die waiting for the right doctor to show up. And we're walking away from a chance to do something there. Maybe maybe it's the right thing to walk away. But let's keep in mind that it's interesting that we're worried about what's happening in Nigeria when we're walking away from it in Afghanistan, where exactly the same philosophy exists.
Philip, do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, unfortunately, we are, and we need to walk away from Afghanistan. And that the Taliban would be a threat to or have the possibility of returning to power, that was on our watch. That was on George Bush's watch when he decided to go to Iraq and not finish the job in Afghanistan and destroy the Taliban. They should have been destroyed in 2002, 2003, not taking our eye off the ball to go do something that wasn't necessary at the time.
Of course, we're accused of dropping bombs from 30,000 feet and killing all these Muslims, and they're going to be the Taliban. Because we don't fight war that way anymore. We don't destroy the way we used to. We try to be surgical, and we pay the price when it's all over in that kind of war.
And we didn't have enough boots on the ground in 2002, 2003 to get the job done, full stop.
The problem is, I mean, we're talking about this as if somehow what we do domestically and what we offer our inner cities and the hope we want there and what we're doing internationally, that somehow they're mutually exclusive. I don't think that they are. I think that, as a strong country, as politically interested people, we should be focused on both things. And there is no doubt that I'm not as isolationist maybe as Mike is here. And that
always,
is that, you know, it does matter what happens over there. Those things do affect. As we learned in September 11th, what happens in Afghanistan and what goes on in the mountains and those hills does directly affect the United States.
We're
trying to stop a movement. We're trying to stop a way of thinking that is being taught by people that have control over people that
movement will affect our security.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce DuMont back in Chicago. During the break, Stephanie, you were making the point about popular culture in America dealing with. I mean, we are all outraged that there are people in the world, the Boko Haram movement, that has kidnapped these children. Their goal is to make sure that women are not educated. And the treatment of women is something that not only the First Lady, but a lot of people should willingly be holding up the way in which the rest of the world treats women. But how are we treating women in the United States on a day-in, day-out basis? Not just economically, but popular culture.
Well, and as the mother of two teenage daughters, you know, I am very, very much aware of what's in the popular culture. And there is a dichotomy where we are appalled at the way that women in certain societies are treated. They're subjugated. They don't have rights. They're not allowed to be educated in things. And yet, at the same time, we allow our daughters to listen, or we promote through awards, singers and videos of girls being beaten by their boyfriends and fighting themselves. And we just had a horrific story here in Chicago on the South Side where one 14-year-old girl shot another 14-year-old girl over a Facebook posting about a boyfriend, and the gun was given to her by her uncle. And there are songs and videos, and there are rap artists and so on that promote this image, this violence among girls.
Yeah, and the violence is in the reality TV area. I got to tell you, I'm as big a free speech advocate as there is, and some of this stuff, I just go, really? Do you get that there's going to be a social impact to this?
But couldn't Barack Obama and couldn't Michelle Obama, couldn't they call a conference? Wouldn't they get the attention of the popular culture and the music industry and those people that in the United States they're perpetuating one treatment of women, and yet they're decrying, rightfully so, this horrendous situation that's happening around the world? It seems to me there's a disconnect.
When you invite these rappers into the White House who sing songs about beating up girls, then, you know, it makes it hard to stomach that. But I know, you know, Bruce, I agree with you because, and I know this is something very dear to you. We've talked about this on the show quite a few times about, you know, we have a president who's actually in a very unique position to use the bully pulpit, so to speak, to decry a culture, to decry what's going on in some of our communities, the communities that look up to him, that have voted him in. And yet there's this, you know, this bizarre dichotomy that we live in.
Think of one name comes to mind is Bill Cosby. Think of what Bill Cosby faces when he talks about such matters. You know, we need to face this problem. Think of the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, a member of Congress, has called him an Uncle Tom because of his views, which are conservative views. And I've been in the university for a while there. Michael Eric Dyson was at DePaul for a while before he went to Penn, and I'm not sure where he is now. And he was insistent that we have no right to be saying these things about this music because this is the voice of the hood and so forth. And this was a white attack upon this black culture, that, and we don't understand. Again, I hear things, I guess maybe because it's in the university, that's just, in many cases, just don't make sense. But you see, that's why I'm almost reticent to say, let's say, you know, that these lyrics are terrible. Because I know that somebody's going to attack me because I don't understand and so forth.
And
we can't win again, just like we can't with these girls.
And all I would say when we talk about this in my classes is understand the impact.
Oh, I agree.
Understand the impact. I'm not one to say, no, you shouldn't say that. I don't believe that words should have that much power. You only give them power, and you have to make a choice about how much power they're going to have. But understand there's going to be an impact here. Mm-hmm. And are you willing to deal with the consequences
of
that?
Do you see a link? Do you see a link when you are decrying the treatment of young girls and keeping education from them with what with the world and these 2 million people and, you know, Ellen and the First Lady and everybody else? They're all holding up the signs. They're decrying, rightfully so, what is happening in Nigeria with young girls who have been kidnapped. Do you see there's a disconnect when those same people are not speaking out vociferously with their soapboxes and their platforms, speaking out against this music that also degrades women and basically they don't want those women educated. They want them beaten. I mean, do you see a disconnect here, or are Mike and I the only ones that are seeing it?
Maybe the disconnect for me is the part that we don't want to talk about is the money that's made on this, and the money that's made on this doesn't just go to the performers. It goes to the record companies and the stockholders of those record companies, who I can pretty much guarantee you aren't majority African American.
So why don't we
or
name
Latino.
Them? Why don't we name them? Why
because
aren't they
money
named?
Money has the privilege of secrecy. I mean, we don't have to. We don't have to. We
Who's
can
the
put
mogul,
the
Russell Simmons.
Russell Simmons.
Yeah, I mean that's where a lot of the money is going. And I've heard Russell; he's a very bright man, and so forth. And I'm not sure though. I agree. It's this whole voice of the I don't know what the word is, the hood or something. It's this whole voice that we're not allowed to attack. I mean, as pale as I am, we're
okay,
just
before,
not allowed to attack.
But
that.
Before well, you
folks,
attack
we're gonna,
it,
we're gonna pick this up on the other side because we're running out of time, I believe. Our thanks at hour number one to Philip Beverly. He's been with us. He is with Chicago State University, and also with us we have Stephanie Hitt and we have Mike Miller, and he is with DePaul University. 1-800-723-8029 is the phone number. If you're listening to this broadcast on radio, we're going to be back for another full hour. And we're going to talk about legalization of marijuana in the next hour, one of our topics, and we'll take your calls. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
and gentlemen, Dick Cavett.
He's one of the greatest television interviewers of all time. The legendary Dick Cavett is coming to Chicago.
There's a certain excitement in the air.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications presents a salute to Dick Cavett, Saturday, June 21st at 6:30.
But this is me. I'm letting it all hang out.
Spend an evening with a television legend.
Why don't we see how the show is?
A salute to Dick Cavett. Go to museum.tv for your tickets now.
Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Featuring commentary by Philip Beverly, Stephanie Hitt, and Mike Miller. Program coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where thunderstorms are ravaging the area. Phone lines open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. We think the phone lines are open. We were told that there was a little cable internet issue with recording of our first hour's broadcast, so we're assuming the phone lines are working, but the only way we'll know is if you pick up a phone and give us a call. 1-800-723-8289. And if you want to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you want to tweet us, we can be tweeted at btbdumont, at btbdumont. And in this hour, we're going to talk about a variety of issues, and we've done this several times over the last several months on this program, but each and every one of our guests, they have pet topics that they deal with on a daily basis, and maybe they don't end up on the front 10 pages of any major newspaper or on the news network newscast, but it's something that they think needs to be discussed. We spent the first hour talking about what is happening in Nigeria and the 276 school children, schoolgirls that are missing and kidnapped. But I want to begin with you, Mike Miller, from DePaul University, Associate Professor of Economics. You've been there for about 30 years, come from, went to Slippery Rock.
Slippery Rock State
College. Slippery Rock in western Pennsylvania.
Yep, I sure did.
Tell us about life in academia, because there are many things that you are involved in that frustrate you and pull your hair out. And
yes,
for those listening on radio, you've pulled a lot of hair out.
That's for sure. And the econ is the least of it. I mean, teaching economics is just a wonderful thing to do for a living. But universities are getting it from several sides. One, enrollments are beginning to slip. And in universities which are very tuition-dependent, this is going to be devastating in terms of attracting quality faculty members, keeping good staff and so forth, and keeping up the facilities that we have. Many small colleges are already beginning to go out of business, something you'd think you would never hear, but small colleges are going out of business. And so we in academia, some people think they're actually using the word bubble, that we have grown so quickly using federal dollars to constantly raise the tuition and constantly buy new Taj Mahal-like facilities to keep more students coming. And it's a bubble that has already burst, or it's about to burst. So that's going to be rough on it. I guess I'm kind of lucky. I'm 60 and kind of on my way out the door in the next 10 years. But it's going to be rough. The other thing is,
part of the competition for what you've said thus far is the online institutions that have popped up, and are they good, and do they do good work?
The final verdict is not quite in on right. Distance learning. It takes a certain kind of student who is self-motivated and bright and learns under that arrangement. It can be a wonderful thing. It can be very inexpensive. It can allow them to do family things at the same time. There is a really important role for online education. There's also a role to be played by traditional learning with a professor in the front and the students there. That's how some other students learn. So that is going to be part of the issue. But the other one is that universities are hurting their own brand by doing stupid things, like inviting people to speak at commencement and then disinviting. This is several organizations have referred to this as the disinvitation season. So among the two, one was Condoleezza Rice, and she was asked to come to Rutgers, and some students and faculty got all upset so that she wouldn't, and they were going to disrupt the event, so she decided to withdraw her name. At Brandeis University, they were going to let this woman named Allie Hersey, she was going to give a talk. She's a black ex-Muslim. She's, I think, now an atheist. But she is very much involved in women's rights, especially in the Islamic world. There was a huge uprising. They disinvited her. And so there's several places in California where invitations were given out. And the universities that do this, they just really ruin the brand, that this is not a place for open discussion where people are challenged. It's the place where you're going to be safe from ideas that don't agree with yours. And that's not what a university is.
Philip Beverly, you spent a lot of time in academia. That's your profession as well. Your reaction to some of the things that Mike had to say.
One of the things Mike didn't mention, since the 1960s, the number of faculty and the number of students attending four-year universities have increased by about the same percentage. The number of administrators has increased by about 153%. So we're getting about three times as many administrators as students and faculty, and that's creating a lot of bloat because some administrative positions don't really create or generate anything for the end product, which is educating our students. Mm-hmm. And it comes with significant costs. At our place, we've hired six-figure administrators who may have a bachelor's degree, who are unable to accomplish basic university tasks.
What about the issue of academic freedom and the ability to sort of censor people because you don't like...
Well, and that's a real concern that I have. I have, I have four children. They're all starting, they're all entering high school. We're starting to look at colleges and apply. And I have a real concern, especially as a conservative Republican, of where can my children go where they're free to express their ideas and beliefs? There's those who are tied into the internet. One of the big stories in the last week was this Princeton freshman who had written an article in the Princeton newspaper about checking his privilege at the door, that because he was a white male, just those two facts alone meant that he was clearly a product of nothing but privilege and was not entitled to share his values or his opinions and to speak out, and how misjudged and how imposing those views were on him, and how his academic freedom is limited in the classroom at an Ivy League institution because he's a white male. His opinion doesn't matter. And that is something that's going on in the campuses, just like when they're disinviting commencement speakers. So this is a real concern because I want my children to be able to engage in debate and to say what they want to say and to talk about history and tradition, even if it's Western in nature, and not be branded a bigot or just a product of white privilege. And this is a real battle that I think is going across academia. I know a lot of conservatives are very concerned about where their kids are going to be able to go to get a good education.
And unfortunately, the privilege exists. Checking it at the door is not ever going to be possible. You have white privilege. How aware are you of it? And how do you use it in how you live your life and relate in the world?
Elaborate what you mean on white privilege. Yeah. What does that mean, Philip?
There's a sociologist, psychologist, and her name just escapes me, but she wrote an article about the knapsack, that there's a number of things that go in the knapsack of having privilege in the culture. Mel Brooks has a line in History of the World, "It's good to be the king." That's talking about male privilege. Mm-hmm. In a patriarchy, men have privilege. It's just the nature of the thing. The greatest privilege I have being a man in a patriarchy is I don't have to think about the other. I don't have to think about a woman's experience or take on the world or whatever. I do, but I don't have to. That's the privilege that I have.
I want to pick up on that because you've got comments. I think, Mike, you've got some comments on that as well. I understand from our technicians that because of this thunderstorm in Chicago that the phone lines are down. I guess the phone lines are down to the entire museum where we do this broadcast from. So don't call. Just think about all your wonderful answers, and we'll be back with more scintillating conversation when we roll on from Chicago.
Fire is representing me because it looks like we're going to have a First Amendment suit against the university here.
Oh, wow. That's
Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us. And we do not have a phone, but we are going to try something. I'm going to give you a new tweet if you are a tweeter and would like to tweet me a question, @Dumo, D-U-M-O, 405. at Dumo 405. Yeah. If you would like to participate in the broadcast, it appears because of the thunderstorms in Chicago, that may be the only way that you can weigh in on this broadcast. So we'll try that and we'll see if anything comes through. Thank you very much for your thoughts. Sure. Now, Stephanie, we're going to turn to you. Pet topic, you got a bee in your bonnet. It's Mother's Day. You want to get it off the table. You want to share what is frustrating you in the world of politics now.
Well, and, you know, this is somewhat off of, you know, we were, you know, decrying what's happening to these young girls in Nigeria. But yet, the feminist hypocrisy that exists, especially in the political arena, and the reemergence of Monica Lewinsky this week is a perfect example of that. For some reason, feminists are standing by Bill Clinton again, and denouncing Monica Lewinsky, and yet here's a perfect example of someone who clearly used his power and took advantage of a young girl. And as a mother of young girls and of boys as well, one of the things that I see, and it happens even in academia, that it as long as the political agenda is there, feminists are willing to check their values and their support for women's rights at the door. We've seen it at institutions where if they have a speaker come, who we saw it at Columbia, for example, when the president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, came. And where was the feminist protest there for his speech? And yet he was allowed to speak at Columbia. It happened at Yale, where there was a member of the Taliban who was admitted as a graduate student. Where were the feminists decrying his presence on campus at that time? They weren't there. And so what I find is that feminism, at least modern American feminism, seems to be more of a pragmatic and political movement and not necessarily concerned with the promotion of true values for women.
Do you then believe that in 2016 that Bill Clinton is fair game in a presidential election?
If Hillary is running, yes, he is. I think he is. He's going to be in the White House with her. And I think it's a legitimate question to ask, who's going to be in the White House.
What do you think, Phil?
I think it's fair game. He's a public figure, former
president. Is it politically astute to do it, Mike?
No, I hope that the Republicans don't focus upon this. I'm not going to brand her because of what he did. I agree with Stephanie that I'm disappointed in the way that women constantly stood beside him. In his own book, he wrote, "I did it because I could." That if there's almost a definition of what is sexual harassment, something I argued all along was the case, that this was sexual harassment, even though she was willing and it was consensual. You can't have that. Phil and I are both in academia. You know that is
power
not
power differential.
That power differential.
Yes.
And my colleagues who were big fans of his absolutely rejected it, and I believe that they reject it to this day. They blame the nuts and the sluts.
Some people are suggesting that the reason that the interview in Vanity Fair with Monica Lewinsky, which was a topic of many of the shows today, the reason that it's out now is because those that support Hillary know that you're not going to sweep it under the rug, but they want to get it out early so it becomes old news in 2 years.
That's true. That is true. However, it doesn't change the fact that there's, you know, it's a bigger problem in politics and our culture and academia, and that is that we're looking at bad behavior and it's being cloaked in some coat that says, well, she's free to use her body and she's using it this way, and they're not willing to step forward and say, wait a minute, there was this power differential. We're willing to look the other way when it serves our political purposes. And that's the biggest problem I have.
Philip?
I have to agree. The complaint that I had about the Clinton administration really post sort of Monica was it wasn't what it could have been because of all the distractions of personal life stuff. And I just remember thinking, you should have known better. You're the president of the United States. That's just not what you do.
No.
you hate to say it, but when you get to be in certain positions, there's a different code of conduct that's expected. And I'm not going to not here to moralize about that. It's just sort of an ethical thing for me. If there's a power differential that's significant, you don't exploit that. That's just unethical.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Absolutely agree. But at the same time, I don't want Hillary to necessarily have to pay the price for what he did. But she did stand beside him. And so Rush Limbaugh was attacked when he called Sandra Fluck, talked about her being a slut. Well, that was the whole thing. It was called the Nuts and Sluts defense, that all these women, including Kathleen Willey and so forth, they were nuts and sluts. And that was okay. The feminists did not go nuts over that. In fact, they embraced the nuts and sluts defense.
If you do not believe that Hillary Clinton should be held accountable for the actions of her husband, which I think a lot of people would agree with, what about her actions as Secretary of State?
Benghazi is back again.
Are we going to keep talking about Benghazi?
And we should, for good reason.
Let's hear from Philip why we should bury this story.
I don't know that we should bury it. It seems to me if there was some there, it would have come out already.
Didn't it come out last week?
No, because all the documents haven't been released. I found out I was driving back from Pennsylvania
today. Edward Snowden releases something every week, it seems like. I got to say, if there was something there,
I don't know.
Would have let it out already.
But don't you think that the recent memo of Ben Rhodes that was released, just not because any congressional investigator found it, Judicial Watch forced it to come out.
Through FOIA, yeah.
Okay. Now, don't you think that was somewhat, or let me ask you this way, I prejudice the question. Is there no significance to that memo in your view?
I think it's a piece of a picture about Benghazi.
Oh, it is, without question.
It's a piece of that picture, but there's other pieces of that picture that could provide some clarity to this, and let's call it truth, that will never come out.
Why
nor
not?
Should they ever come out, because there are national security interests there. There was an intelligence operation going on with Benghazi.
It was CIA, I agree.
CIA is involved in this in a way that we cannot talk about.
That's not why it's being covered up. I mean, you say there's no there. There is a there, and that's four dead Americans. Yeah. And we are seeing more and more of what actually did happen and the timeline. And there are still many questions that have not been answered through the last 19 months of investigations and whatever little documents that have been sort of piddled out there. And that is the problem. We still don't know where the president was. We still don't know what Hillary was doing. We don't have satisfactory answers. Hillary has obfuscated this thing completely. I mean, remember, she was supposed to testify, and just before she resigned, she had a fainting spell.
Yeah.
This has been a pattern.
Then she showed up. Who cares?
And then she showed up, and she belittled the whole process by saying, what difference does it make? And the only thing that I'm mad about in the Republicans is that nobody jumped down on her at that moment. What difference does it make is there are four dead Americans, and that's exactly precisely.
Phil, I had some of the same reaction, because I don't like wasting time on things if there's nothing there. But if you Google Trey Gowdy, is that his name?
Yes.
Questions regarding Benghazi. I saw a video. It was on McWhat's-His-Face report. John
McLaughlin.
McLaughlin report. Yeah. And they played the entire thing. I didn't realize there were that many unanswered questions about all these requests for more support. How come that didn't happen? We still don't know why no one was called to at least try to bring in some air power or something to protect the two men who were on the roof. And he had all these, which I didn't know about. In fact, he convinced me that there's something here.
And might the answers to those questions be compromising to national security in some way?
I can accept. I have no problem with national security.
And if that's the case, you ask, say, 10 questions that now generate 10 more, and then when you don't want to answer the 10 more, now you're covering something up instead of stopping at the beginning.
Folks, there are two issues here. There is the insufficient security at the consulate, and whether or not there was significant warnings that more people should be there. There's three questions. The question is, why was not the United States able to scramble some military support to beef up the support once the attack started. And then those are all issues that could go into national security. I agree with you. If you start pulling that that thread, that's could step on some national security issues. I understand that. However, the other piece, which is the fabrication of a story that was being peddled by the Secretary of State, by Ms. Rice on all the shows, and by the president, that this somehow was tied to a video, when the head of intelligence and CIA said it was not tied to a video. That is creating a lie to tell to the American people 5 or 6 weeks before an election. They were covering their own rear ends. Now, again, every administration would do it. I'm not, you know, I'm not saying this would not happen in other administrations. But in this particular administration, it's something we know that Ms. Rice was told certain things to say and go on all the shows, and it was a lie, pure and simple. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. Stephanie Hitt is one of our Republicans. Mike Miller is here. He is with DePaul University. And Philip Beverly is with Chicago State University. And we're talking about a variety of issues. And we were talking about Benghazi. And I had made the particular point that this is an issue that has many different, you know, chapters to it. But the one that concerns me the most is the one that does not border on national security. It borders on protecting the rear end of the President of the United States and sending out your top diplomat and basically feeding a bunch of BS to the American people when American lives were lost, and blaming it on a video when there was no evidence that the video, I mean, how do you not say that was a lie? That was an orchestrated lie to the American people.
Phil, you get into those.
I want to get Phil's response to that.
I would say, as events unfold on the ground, separated by time and distance, and I'm not talking about Benghazi, I'm talking about just generally situations, those are fluid situations, and you got to go with your best information. If it comes out later that you had the data that said X and you told the world Y, then you got to be held to account for why'd you tell the world Y if you knew you had X. I can get with that. I don't know that I think the Benghazi situation is somewhere in between that, because the more questions you ask, the more questions you'll need to ask. And at some point when you say, I can't answer those questions, then you're suddenly seen as, oh, well, wait a second, you started talking here, and now you're shutting down and not being transparent.
But by asking these questions, and this is why this is important, by asking these questions and by doggedly pursuing the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, it really will allow the American people to once again render a judgment on the leader in waiting who wants to lead this nation and this world. And she happens to be someone who was the Secretary of State when this happened. And very little has been said about what she was doing and where she was and what was her reaction, other than repeating that it was tied to the video. So she repeated the same thing that Rice did on the shows. So here is the Secretary of State. Now, did she not know what was really going on? Or was she lying to? And now it's possible that she will get a chance to be a heartbeat away from the presidency in 2016. And I don't care whether anybody spends 1 second talking about Bill Clinton. It is her record as Secretary of State. That is the issue. And the big dark mark on her Secretary of State's tenure is Benghazi. Because four Americans died there.
And the big black mark on a prior president was 4,400 Americans dying in Iraq.
And
he's
never going to the polls again.
I get it. Yeah. And should she be held to account for it? Yeah. Now it becomes a matter of process. Because what can she talk about? Where was she at and what was she
doing? Oh, I don't know. I fainted and I can't remember. Good God.
You know, you posited two questions. What, she's either lying about it or she didn't know what was going on.
And maybe there's a third option.
Both of those questions is disturbing.
And maybe there's a third option. Maybe she can't talk about where she was because it involves something else.
She's never claimed any privilege whatsoever.
We're not talking about claiming privilege. Yeah. Claiming privilege. If she's you give two choices. If there's a third option, that opens up that whole other set of questions that you can't even go down that road with.
But she's never claimed that.
She's never claimed that.
She has never.
She can't claim that.
Yes, she can. You can.
I'm saying the bigger piece, telling the American people one story when it wasn't accurate,
and then, by the way.
In the course of the presidential election, in the debate, when Romney said there were two things that Romney said,
yeah. Russia.
He said Russia is the biggest problem facing the United States, and everybody laughed at him.
Yes. Oops.
and then he said, why didn't you use the word terrorism? And he was made to be a fool by suggesting that. Right. And the things that Romney said in that one debate where, again, he really got beaten up by the media in the post-analysis and saved by the moderator at one particular point. I mean, much of what he said has turned out to be the truth.
Right.
The president was not totally candid there.
There's no doubt that also that from what I've seen, all the data was clearly that it had nothing to do with the video. Nothing supported the idea that it had anything to do with the video. And when those caskets came back and they were met at Dover and the Secretary of State was there, she brought up, if I remember correctly, she brought up the video. And we're going to have to go after this
guy. She also did ads on Pakistani TV discussing the video. That's one thing that's been underreported. She actually recorded, video herself.
How are we going to go after this
American? On Pakistani TV talking about the video.
Scary. And so once we know, what's the end game here? So you have an investigation, partisan or nonpartisan, because we know if it's going to be in Congress, it's going to be partisan, and the minority won't get to ask questions because somebody like Daryl Issa will shut down somebody's microphone or whatever they'll do. If it's nonpartisan,
Gowdy won't.
If they're nonpartisan and it's like a 9/11 commission, what's the end game to finding out? Is it knowledge for knowledge's sake?
Well, part of it
or is there something that needs to be changed in the foreign policy communications mechanism, decision-making mechanism? What's our end game
here? One reason we like a lot of governors have become president is because they have proved through their actions that they can manage. As I remember it, when Hillary was involved in Hillary Care back in the 90s, the one thing that was a slam against her, it wasn't how bright she is. It isn't how well-educated she is. That her management skills, to use the expression they used back then, is ham-handed. She doesn't have finesse in any way, what you would call a management skill. And I don't know if I want another president who has no management skills. I think the current president doesn't seem to have a lot of. He's a charismatic man, and so forth. But I'm not so sure he has much in terms of management skills.
And they're legitimate questions to ask. There was an entire summer before these events happened where there were cables, what the British were doing, and how she was managing that State Department and those offices and that satellite office. And again, how she in her role reacted once the threat was clear. And those go directly to her ability to be president.
We discussed this last week. I want to get a quick response from everybody. At this moment in time, do you think that Hillary Clinton is going to run for president, Stephanie? With all that's going on, she's about to be a grandmother. She knows everything's hitting the fan. Monica Lewinsky's out there, you know. Is it worth it?
If I'm betting at the tables, I'm going to say no. Whether it's her choice or enough of a public outcry, I do not believe she will be the Democratic nominee.
I think that she will, but it's going to be very distasteful. When they went after John McCain because of his age, and when they went after Ronald Reagan because of his age, no one said it was because you were sexist. You know, if we go after Hillary because of her age, it's going to be dirty. It's going to be, how dare you bring up the fact that she's got wrinkles or whatever the heck is going to case, even though people brought up about Ronald Reagan being a doddering old fool and John McCain would probably be dead before the end of his first term. All these things, all these attacks upon the age of these men, the same ones could be used against this woman. She'll be 69 years old.
When inaugurated.
With a history of fainting.
And so. I think some people with age have wisdom. So I'm not concerned as much about her age, but man, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be used and it's going to be attacked.
I think in answer to your specific question, will she run? Yeah, I think she sort of has to. I don't know that she wins the nomination, though.
That would be interesting.
Okay, yeah. Now you've opened another can of worms. Who beats her?
I think there's a dark horse. I think
someone not known at this moment, like. So. Give us a name. You can't.
Tease
us like this.
Democratic governors, no.
Just so it's not Elizabeth.
You just don't think it's going to be her.
I just don't think it'll be her.
I will too. I'll take Hillary over Elizabeth.
I think there's a lot of underlying Hillary fatigue outside of the sort of inner core of Hillary supporters who are pushing a particular agenda to get the country over the hump of never having a woman serve in the White House, right? And but beyond that, it has to be the right woman.
Yeah.
It has to be the right woman.
Or is there another historical moment? I know today Marco Rubio was on one of the Sunday shows with Jonathan Carl on ABC, and he's been in New Hampshire. He's been campaigning. Marco Rubio looked and sounded more like a presidential candidate than he has.
And
in the
he's been very outspoken on Ukraine and Putin over the last couple of weeks. He's
didn't
been
he say
very
even
outspoken.
He could be president? I mean, he could handle the job.
He's ready for it.
What's interesting about that is there's only probably four men in the world who could be ready for being president.
Yeah, and they've been president.
Yeah. There's nobody who's ready to be president.
So is America. If America is at this pivotal point, and we seem to be in an era of gender and media politics, is America more thirsting for a woman to be the president or a Hispanic to be the president? Mm-hmm. That's the question. We'll be back with that discussion when we roll on from Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. If you're listening coast to coast, there's been a big thunderstorm in the Chicagoland area. It has knocked out our phones. So hopefully you are hearing us. Hopefully you're hearing us. Or we're just talking to the four of us there. Hopefully you're hearing us, but you're not calling us because the phones are not working tonight. And we will blame that on global warming. It's global warming.
Lack of sun.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and you were making a point about Hillary Clinton during the break. So put that on the record.
There, you know, among many circles, there's a strong feeling that because Obama's administration has not been nearly as successful or transparent as provided, and given our economic woes and so on, that the thrill or excitement of having elected the first black president sort of has worn off. And so the concern is, are we going to get caught up in the thrill and experiment and hope of electing the first woman president?
Or the first Hispanic.
Or Hispanic as the experiment, as opposed to the truly best qualified and most experienced person for the job. And that's
a
question.
But you would admit that a woman or a Hispanic could be the best suited.
There's no guarantee, but to run,
people are going
to be elected
what you said,
because of being a woman or a Hispanic or whatever, you know, human variation we have, that is not a basis alone anymore. We've learned over these last 8 years that lack of experience, lack of managerial skill, lack of governing abilities does in fact hurt us. And our president is not a figurehead. But
winning an election is about swaying the vote of a very small group of people.
Yes,
correct.
And they may not care about the bigger, broader issues. They may not care about competence. They're going to care about, okay, It's a woman, and I'm a woman, and I'm going to vote for her. Or I'm a Hispanic, or he's cute, or whatever the case may be. They will make their decisions not necessarily on intellectual or political belief. It'll be the way they look. The way they look.
There is clearly a percentage, and it's on both sides of the aisle. Oh, yeah. There is a percentage.
But it's the deciding group to decide who wins.
The question will be, I think, as it was in the last one, and that is independence. And are they independent? Are they looking for economic answers? Are they looking for economic solutions?
Oh, I think so.
And what is the economic solution, Mr. Economist?
Less regulation. I think even if the president came out and talked about economic growth as opposed to income redistribution, it would make a difference. But his full focus is on income redistribution.
Before we came to this hour, I had mentioned that we were going to talk about legalization of marijuana because you had mentioned it, Stephanie, in one of the breaks. We're running out of time in the broadcast this evening for a full-blown debate on that subject. We could do a whole show on it. But whereas I believe that the two professors that are here think that maybe the political pendulum is swinging towards a libertarian perspective on legalization of marijuana, whether it is for medicinal purposes or, as in some states, recreational purposes, you don't believe necessarily that the march towards legalization of marijuana will happen, and you certainly don't want it to happen.
That is correct. I think we are, for the two states that do have legal, it was Oregon or Washington?
Washington
and Colorado. They're actually seeing a steady, steady increase in traffic accidents and so on related to
Until enforcement changes.
Let's not ignore the recent Harvard study a couple weeks ago that came out that showed that, in fact, there are significant effects on especially the teenage brain that are long-term effects from the casual experimental use of marijuana.
But teenagers shouldn't be smoking marijuana anyway, just like they shouldn't be drinking alcohol.
But when we legalize it, there is no doubt that there's a trickle-down. When you open the door for one age group, it trickles down to the lower age
group. I completely disagree.
Go ahead.
It'll be in the house.
The people that want to drink are going to drink. Mm-hmm. Not because it's legal, but because they want to. The people who want to smoke are going to smoke. Not because it's legal, but because they want to.
And they can get it easily. And getting it more, if a parent can get it more easily in the house, the kid's going to get it more easily.
Or
don't you think the teenagers today can probably get pot parents quicker than they can get cigarettes over the counter somewhere?
Probably, but we are looking at something that has, by many accounts, been proven as a gateway drug. If you talk to drug addicts, they often say, "I started it."
And the addict
Let's let our Republican professor is going to talk.
Libertarian.
When it comes to this issue, I've also looked at the economics, and this is just so damaging to fight the war on drugs. It destroys so many lives who could not otherwise be destroyed. But just think of the damage that alcohol does. I mean, think of when we're talking about university campuses, one of the biggest problems we have is binge drinking.
Yeah.
And this leads to sexual problems between the male and female. And this is – drinking is behind a lot of that. And we don't think about outlawing a drink, which we shouldn't, because used sensibly, it's fine. I never used marijuana.
We also tried it once.
And it failed.
No, we tried.
Prohibition.
There were unintended consequences.
Yes. And from all I've heard about the research, use of marijuana, which I've never used, used occasionally is going to do nothing to you. It's not going to ruin you the way that
cocaine or heroin.
Well,
would.
And I
have much less, more torn when it comes to cocaine and heroin and so forth and meth, but marijuana, I just don't get it.
From a political standpoint, do you think the march towards legalization and relaxation in states is it going to be at the same pace that legalizing same-sex marriage is, or do you think it's going to be a much slower, longer rampant?
No, I think it'll actually. I think it'll be pretty quick, and the feds will be sort of overcome by events, and suddenly there'll be some very quick vote in the Congress that marijuana is no longer Schedule I drug because so many states have crossed the threshold either for medicinal marijuana or for outright legalizing it. Yeah. And I think that's just on economic grounds.
Well, there is a nice thing, though. We can let Colorado and Washington be the test case.
Experiment. Yep.
And Illinois, if we see them, and there's no doubt when you first legalize it, people are going to go nuts with it, and that's what's happening. Tell me in a year or two, and then we could say Illinois, wherever. Let's consider it.
Absolutely.
That was Mike Miller from DePaul University, Philip Beverly from Chicago State University, and Stephanie Hitt, thank you very much. Happy Mother's Day to you.
Thank you very much.
Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers that are listening to the broadcast this evening. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Todd Nebel and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Again, forgive my horrible cough and my wheezing throughout the program this evening, but it's live radio, folks. You get it when I'm sound, and you get it when I'm weak, and tonight was not a great night. But anyway, I'll be back next week, Lord willing. Until then, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dick Cavett.
He's one of the greatest television interviewers of all time. The legendary Dick Cavett is coming to Chicago.
There's a certain excitement in the air.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications presents a salute to Dick Cavett, Saturday, June 21st at 6:30.
But this is me. I'm letting it all hang out.
Spend an evening with a television legend.
Why don't we see how the show is?
A salute to Dick Cavett. Go to museum.tv for your tickets now.